Welcome to the first of three regular sessions of the annual 16th Century Conference. And it's also my pleasure that this is not not the only session on Renaissance education. When Jean-Marie asked me last year at the Guelph Conference to attempt to put together a session on education this year, I eagerly accepted. Because I believe it to be an area that permeates indeed much scholarship of the literary, philosophical, and social history kind, but that it is at the same time sadly neglected in a formal sense at conferences and is an area much in need of methodological heuristic revision at the present time. Happily, Professor Paul Grendler at the University of Toronto apparently shared some of my concerns as well. So we not only have one session, today's on higher education, but we have another tomorrow morning on pre-university education. Some $150 later in telephone calls and telegrams across the North American continent and to Europe, this experience putting together the session persuaded me of at least one reassuring factor. That despite the difficulties of posed by the high cost of travel, scholars of the Renaissance indeed still do travel. Over 50% of those contacted were either just leaving for Europe or a North American center of repute, such as the Center of Reformation Studies here, had just returned from a session sur place, or indeed were still there. The three scholars who happily accepted to give papers today were quite typical and illustrious examples of this phenomenon. Professor Guy Fitch-Leiter, and I shall introduce them now briefly, because I don't think they really need much introduction, but Professor Guy Fitch-Leiter, who teaches at the University of Texas in Austin, indeed was at Corpus Christi College, Oxford, where he was doing research on sections in the University, the new history of the University of Oxford, the sections on theology, which he is writing, and also the social history sections. He has now returned with three-quarters of his papers, awaiting the arrival of, indeed, his research materials. Professor Kittleson of The Ohio State University, who has given many papers, including at this conference, numerous publications, has edited a recent symposium on universities in transition, which will likely appear at the Ohio State University Press shortly, and is presently working on the late Reformation in Strasbourg. Professor Stephen Rowan has long been associated with the Center for Reformation Studies, teaches history at the University of Missouri here in St. Louis, a recipient of many fellowships. I first saw Professor Rowan, though we didn't meet formally, at the conference for the International Society for the History of Rhetoric at Newberry Library about 2 years ago. He was then doing research on his Zosius volume, which he has continued at the Institut für Rechtsgeschichte in Freiburg im Breisgau, from which he has just returned. I understand that his major project at the present time is indeed a biography of the great jurist Ulrich Zosius. I'd like, therefore, to proceed immediately with the three papers, after which I shall introduce Professor Harrison, who will be giving the formal commentary. Subsequent to his formal commentary, we shall have an opportunity, I'm sure, to address questions to the persons who have delivered papers and to the commentator. So I'll call on Professor Guy Fitch-Leiter.
Thank you. The allusion to my papers is a very genuine one. The translation of Edward Powell's work, on which most of this paper is based, arrived in Austin on Tuesday night. So I am going to read you parts of it. You'll forgive me if I read my own handwriting, if I try to read my own handwriting. The title of my paper is slightly different from the one in the program. Telegrams can get, words in international telegrams cost money. than being very parsimonious. I sense a sort of cryptic title, which James made intelligible, but slightly changed the emphasis. I'm interested in the bad guys. The title is Oxford Confronts Heresy in the Early 16th Century. I'm interested in the people who wanted to get rid of it, not the people who wanted to get more of it. In midsummer 1540, in an attempt to demonstrate a via media of punishment for religious heterodoxy, Henry VIII caused to be hanged, alongside the Lutheran heretic Robert Barnes, the conservative, devoutly orthodox, if sometimes incautious, Roman Catholic theologian Edward Powell. I will continue to call him Edward Powell because that's the way we in America say it. It's probably pronounced Poole, but you can live with that. It's Powell in the card catalog. Few events more dramatically illustrated the changes in English religious life since the early 1520s. He was killed in 1540. When the same Edward Powell, a leading light among Oxford theologians, had been one of Henry's most learned allies in the original fight against Lutheranism. In his writings during those earlier years, Powell was also part of another movement. Throughout Europe, doctors and faculties of many universities, notably Paris, Louvain, Cologne, Oxford, and Cambridge, were deciding to issue, either by their own initiative and authority, or in response to requests from various princes and prelates, condemnations of Lutheran ideas and proscriptions of Lutheran books. Since I've elsewhere described at great length and analyzed the path by which these continental universities had come to claim this authority, how they exercised it, and what the reactions to their authority were, I would here like to focus on a similar episode in Oxford's history to show a university at work confronting heresy and to introduce a new voice into that perennial hotbed of Renaissance scholars, the so-called Oxford Reformers, Moore, Collett, Erasmus, etc., and the whole question of the nature of early Tudor Christian humanism. It is hard to exaggerate the problem of heresy for the minds of the early 16th century. Any heresy was, of course, an iniquitous disease, as an Oxford theologian called it, which could infect the mind of the church and endanger the souls of all Christians. It was, as the popes never failed to remind princes, a political problem which usually fomented rebellion. It often acted to coalesce social and economic tensions into open attacks on the traditional order. But a learned heresy, as opposed to a mere popular heresy, a learned heresy, as Luther certainly was, posed a particular challenge to universities. Universities throughout their history were likely to be both nurseries of heresies and also the nurturing grounds for those people who, to stretch a metaphor, would massacre the innocent or not so innocent ideas. Universities have a very ambiguous relationship to heresy. As Oxford knew all too well, humiliation and suspicion were the costs paid by a university when a perpetrator of a heresy was a famous alumnus. So heresy was a challenge to universities, and especially to their theological faculties, to do their jobs, to refute error, to proclaim orthodoxy, to train thinkers and preachers to oppose the heretics, in short, to fulfill all these claims, which they made increasingly often during the later Middle Ages, to act as religious authorities. If I have a kind of broad message that I'm trying to get across, I guess that's it, that late medieval intellectual historians, early Reformation intellectual historians, in their eagerness to get those texts out, and of course they're massive manuscript texts that still need editing, all too often forget what theologians were there for. They weren't there to write manuscripts for us to edit. And yet, so often they're kind of treated that way. Theologians had the self-conception of themselves as professors of orthodoxy. They were there to uphold truth, refute error. And if we don't understand that role of the theological faculties, then I think we misunderstand many of the texts. From their earliest days as corporate bodies, but especially during and after the Great Schism, when the nature and locus of religious authority were being widely debated, universities greatly expanded their claims to possess religious authority.
While many who felt the sting of their condemnations responded with ridicule or appeals to higher authority, especially Melanchthon and Zwingli, others showed considerable concern about the opinions of the universities. Luther, for example, sought right up to his death, in fact, it was the last thing he was still writing, to refute explicitly the 1520 Louvain condemnations of his ideas. He came back to this three or four times during his life and tried to refute them. Despite his biting mockery of those professors, he showed similar anxiety over very few of his opponents. Well into the 17th century, universities continued to be consulted by those in authority, continued to issue both condemnations of men and ideas and lists of prescribed books, in an attempt to preserve orthodoxy, though by the 17th century, of various stripes. In order to understand the Oxford mentality of the early 16th century, we must realize that Oxford still wrestled with the colossal shadow of John Wycliffe. Much of the institutional and intellectual history of the university from the late 14th century down to the Reformation has to be seen as a reaction to Wycliffe and his legacy. All of the Oxford colleges founded during this period made explicit references to the dangers of heresy. One, begun by Richard Fleming, a former Wycliffeite adherent himself, it's nothing worse than a late convert, was intended solely to train students in theology to combat heresy, or, in his picturesque words in his preface to the statutes, to overcome those who with their swinish snouts imperil the pearls of true theology. We don't write statutes like that for universities anymore. I think we ought to take a lesson. Most of the notable writings of 15th century Oxford theologians, notably Thomas Netter, Reginald Peacock, Thomas Gascoigne, were explicitly directed toward refuting Wycliffeite views. But despite these and other efforts to assert its orthodoxy, the taint of Wycliffism caused Oxford to suffer humiliation at home at the hands of the Archbishop of Canterbury, abroad at the Council of Constance, and among intellectual circles from other universities, especially Paris and Heidelberg, who never seemed to tire of reminding them in letters and public declarations of their past sins. Paris is wonderful. They keep saying, beginning every public statement, whenever there's an international congress, we hate to bring this up again. We really do. But we would like to call attention to the fact that Oxford's here, and we want to know if they're still Wycliffeites. It's wonderful international rivalry. It's better than football. By the 16th century, Oxford had declined precipitously from its august position in the 13th and 14th centuries as one of the most respected universities in Europe. Religious authorities must clearly remain unsullied in their relationships with truth if they are to keep their authority. Oxford suffered for having not done so. This trauma also caused any Oxford theologian, when confronted with heterodox ideas of almost any sort, to hear in them the strong accents of Wycliffe. Edward Powell, as we'll see, was no exception. Lutheran books were certainly available for purchase above the counter, quite openly, in Oxford by the beginning of 1520. A few were bought. We have the list of a famous bookseller. He sold about 3,000 books during 1520, of which 13 were Lutheran. So if you're a quantitative historian, you can figure that out. Not terribly impressive, but they were at least available. Sometime between July 1520 and March 1521, Cardinal Wolsey forbade the importation and reading of Luther's writings. Archbishop Warham, Canterbury, remained disturbed, and in a letter singled out the situation in Oxford for particular concern. He had received letters, he said, stating that the university was infected with Lutheranism, that many of the forbidden books were still circulating there and being openly discussed. He asked Wolsey to order the university authorities to examine those suspected of any ideas and to get rid of them if necessary. In April 1521, a month or so after this, Pope Leo X wrote to Wolsey to urge a public burning of Luther's books, and suggested that in addition, Wolsey, himself an Oxford-trained theologian, whom most people forget that Wolsey and others should read Luther and refute him for the Catholic faith. Wolsey wrote a letter almost immediately to Oxford to request that two or three of their brightest doctors be sent to London to, quote, examine and refute those opinions of Luther which you spell L-E-W-T-H-E-R. They hadn't worked that out. Those opinions of Luther which fight against the Catholic faith. Oxford, ever eager to please, sent four. John Roper, the main professor of divinity. John Kenton, a Franciscan friar, who later was his successor. Thomas Brinknell, and John de Caloribus, a Dominican who was a favorite of Wolsey's. In May, Henry VIII notified the Pope that he had called together all the learned men of his kingdom to denounce Lutheranism. At the same time, there was a large-scale public burning of Lutheran books at St. Paul's. The Venetian ambassador wrote that, quote, Friar Martin is to be proclaimed a heretic and his works burnt. He has already been sentenced, and on Sunday, Cardinal Wolsey will publish the condemnation by the Concilii of Cambridge and Oxford as a heretic. This word has troubled those university historians who've ever noticed it, the three of us, because Concilii doesn't mean much in this context, I think. But it probably refers simply to the decision made at that April gathering of learned representatives, because we can find no formal evidence that Oxford ever issued a formal condemnation of Luther. It's significant, I think, that the ambassador saw this as a natural function of universities, but I think it's also significant that Oxford could never quite get up its courage to do so. It wasn't that it wanted to be Lutheran, it just didn't have much courage at this point. Our first direct evidence of Oxford's involvement in the fight against Luther comes in a letter to Edmund Audley, Bishop of Salisbury, dated 2 days before Christmas, 1521. This is now 6 months later than this public burning, than this first council. In this letter, which I have a copy if anybody would like to read, the university starts off in typical fashion saying, thank you for all your patronage for us, etc. The university couldn't exist without you. Your name is immortal among us. It finally gets to the point after several paragraphs and says, you pay the salary of Edward Powell, who is one of our brightest theologians, but technically a canon of your cathedral. Can you please give him a leave of absence without loss of revenue so he can come write a book against Luther? Edmund Audley agreed. A letter written almost exactly the same time to Powell says, you must come and refute the heresies of Luther, as you have undertaken in private to us that you will do. This will benefit the whole Christian world. Continue on as you have begun, for these heresies may be more difficult to uproot later on if they are suffered to grow now. What you have just finished is excellent. This is the first evidence we have that he's written anything. Complete the whole work as soon and as well as you can to please the king and the cardinal, Wolsey, and to gain glory for the university. Okay, that brings us finally to Edward Powell. Now, do it fairly quickly. Powell was a student at Oxford from the 1490s on. Thus, he was a student at Oxford at the time when John Colet was giving his famous lectures, when Erasmus was a teacher there. He overlapped them almost exactly. He may have gone and studied at Paris in 1501, 1502. He received a license to do so, but we don't have any evidence that he actually ever got there. When he came back to Oxford, or when he stayed at Oxford, whichever he did, he was allowed or requested by the Oxford congregation, that is the degree-granting body of the university, to lecture on St. Augustine's De Trinitate for his doctoral teaching obligation, instead of the usual lectures on Scotus or Peter Lombard. I've examined the entire records of the Oxford congregation, which assigned these teaching obligations to every bachelor and every doctor of theology. I studied them 1450 to 1550. This is the only time anyone is asked to give public lectures on a church father. As late as the 1540s, it's still Lombard and Scotus, as Peter Martyr complains when he comes to teach there. This seems to indicate to me, no one as far as I know has noticed this except me, that Powell was recognized very early, 1506, 1507, as someone who was qualified to lecture on the Church Fathers, and it shows, I think, that Oxford at least valued them to some extent. Well, whatever may have happened between these lectures in 1506-7 and his writing of the book, we're just not sure. Intellectually, there's no evidence for his development. But in the early 1520, 1521, He began a book, De Immutate Ecclesiae, a defense of the papacy and the Eucharist against the attacks on Luther. He then, as the university indicated, completed his book by writing a detailed refutation of Luther's Babylonian captivity of the church. I can read you the whole title of his work if you want to. You probably don't want to hear it. The important thing is that the subtitle, after the long Latin main title, is a book against against Brother Martin Luther, infamous and a Wycliffeite. Here's an Oxford man who clearly sees Luther as a Wycliffeite and can only really see him in that way. Now, look, Powell was not the only person writing against Luther. We know that the abbot of Winchcombe, Richard Kidderminster, who was another famous theologian, wrote a book attacking Luther's view of indulgences. We also know that each of those other men that I mentioned earlier, Roper, Brinknell, those fellows, also wrote a book refuting Luther. The university, however, having read them all, said Powell's is the best one. We're going to hold these others. If you really want them, we'll send them to you. But other than that, we'll just send you Powell's. I've spent 6 months looking for those other ones to see what I can find, and I can't find them. But that gives you a sense of what the university was doing, of how it organized itself. It sent out calls for its four or five best theologians who were either there or somewhere else and said, write this book. What Oxford said in its letter to Cardinal Wolsey recommending Powell's work, we're sending this to you, but we're not sending a formal condemnation of Luther, because the university as such has never been in the habit of writing against a heretic, although it may approve the efforts of individuals who do so. Here is a place where Oxford is very different from Paris or Cologne, and I think this really indicates the feeling that Oxford had about being burned from its Wycliffeite days. They are no longer confident enough as a faculty, or feel like they have authority enough as a faculty, to issue condemnations on their own right. Let me just conclude, really, with a few indications about Powell's book. It's 360 pages long, so I can't do everything. First, Powell had a problem. As most of you know, the king had already written a book defending the seven sacraments against Luther. So here he was, he'd gotten Henry's little 60-page book, and he's got to somehow say that my 360-page one was necessary. Here's what he says in the introduction. Most of my comments will come from the introduction and the conclusion. When, some time ago, I received the Christian and very Catholic work which Henry VIII of England wrote with the highest and most astonishing subtlety on Luther, I read the work most carefully. I do not believe that I must now be silent in such a matter, despite this book. I have found the royal work to be completely complete, or totally complete, in all its parts. It lacks no strength in which it subdues and destroys Luther. But it certainly seems to me to be both slothful and base for the soldier to be willing to sleep in the castle while the commander fights on the front line. There's a nice little topos if you need that. He compares Henry to Solomon, but says even Solomon would not expect people to remain silent. Goes on in this kind of vein. He also showed himself to be very aware of the role of universities and the role of increasing theological specialization. He says, for example, I'm not going to talk about indulgences because Kidderminster is an expert on that. This is something we usually don't think about in early theologians, that they at least had some specializations in what they knew about. He's going to concentrate on sacraments, which he says he knows best, and let Kidderminster write about indulgences. He also submits all of his things to the approval of the Catholic theologians, and especially those of Oxford. He attacks Luther throughout for going off on his own, for being willing to write without the authority of a university backing him up. And he says he won't publish anything unless the scholars of Oxford, who shine very brightly in their knowledge of things human and divine, approve of what he's doing. It's their judgment that will give what he says weight. The sources and style of his argument are, I think, interesting. He accepts the fact that Luther will only be convinced by quotations from Holy Scripture. He does not, like many, including many continental scholars do in their earliest reactions to Luther, attempt to convince him by the usual standard medieval arguments. He accepts right off that Luther will only be convinced by quotations from Scripture, and only twice in 360 pages does Powell quote a modern theologian. One of those times is Erasmus. He does cite the Church Fathers as authorities against Luther constantly, especially Jerome, Augustine, and Cyprian. He varies in tone from charity and persuasion to serious argument to almost apoplectic outbursts of anger and frustration. His major thrusts are that Luther misuses Scripture and that he is self-contradictory. The quote that comes up over and over again is, "Luther fights always against himself." The latter is perhaps drawn from Luther's own rhetorical ploys in the Babylonian captivity. That's the place I find it the most common. The real question, the one I want to end with, is the question of, was Powell a humanist? What does that matter? First, in his attitudes toward Erasmus, he is quite different from what you would expect from a scholastically trained theologian at a very conservative institution. First, he says that Erasmus is the leading theologian of the time, that many people have for some time now been expecting great things from you. He interrupted page 115 to 118, and almost like a letter to Erasmus, saying that there is a considerable disagreement among intellectuals about what Erasmus and where Erasmus and Luther stand on certain issues. Erasmus is the most learned and skillful man available to confront Luther, and yet Erasmus remains silent. Why, he says, why do you not attack this pernicious heresy? Some people are saying that in your recent writings, Erasmus has become Lutheranized, just as Luther is clearly Erasmianized. There's a non-humanist use of Latin, but still, he's getting his point across. Augustine and Jerome were never hesitant to contend with heretics, he says. Why are you, Erasmus, silent? This attitude toward Erasmus is, I think, very interesting. I mean, accepting him, which I think more scholastics than are usually thought did, if you read the writings at Louvain in Paris, accepting him as a major theologian, but being puzzled about why he doesn't function as a theologian. They didn't want Erasmus to be a scholar. They wanted him to be a polemical theologian, which they understood. Finally, on this question of was he a humanist, he really approaches the problem himself in the conclusion. He has said several times, "My words are inadequate for the task at hand." But he says at one point, "But even Homer slept sometimes." So that doesn't mean his writings aren't good. So if parts of my writings aren't as good as others, remember that even Homer slept at some point. He concludes by saying, "Therefore I now make an end of defending the New Testament priesthood and the seven sacraments against Luther. I ask only this of my readers, to read these things not with a heavy but an open and serene mind. Even if these things don't reverberate with Ciceronian eloquence, nevertheless these things exude the gospel truth, which doesn't wish for slickness of words. If in these things which I have done my effort wasn't so consummate as such matters demand, nevertheless I have certainly presented an opportunity to the more learned among you who think more brilliantly in this matter than I do to do better in their things against Luther. This is my task. The whole consideration of this matter must be committed entirely to the judgment of the scholars at Oxford, among whom the knowledge of things human and divine has always shone so brightly." He's stealing from his own introduction. He's probably tired by that point. Sadly, the story lacks a rousing ending. The other Oxford writings, as I've said, apparently have not survived. Powell's own writings, as far as we know, had little impact, and Luther didn't even mention him. Powell's honorable, but at times foolhardy public Catholicism, his loyalty to Queen Catherine of Aragon, trailed him through the 1520s and 30s and led to his death on the scaffold.
For all of that, the life of Edward Powell, the book he wrote, and the process which produced it are important, I think, for Reformation historians. It contrasts what's happening at Oxford and the change at Oxford to what's happening in the more polemically oriented continental universities at the time. I think we have to make a lot of distinctions between universities and their situations, which I've tried to do in a separate article. It shows how scholastic training and Christian humanist tendencies can coexist in single minds and whole faculties, and force us to rethink the old stale dichotomies. I think that's one of the things we really need to get rid of more than almost anything else, is this simple scholastic humanist dichotomy. Because when you start looking at almost any individual, it just simply doesn't work. The whole series of events, third point, takes us a long step closer to the real world of the early 16th century theologians, the real world of the theological faculties, the real mentality of those professors of the traditional theological paradigm who at this moment were under extreme pressure. I think if I call for anything here, it's for more work on the conservative opponents of Luther, who I think will tell us a great deal about Luther. Thank you.
I too have a change in the topic of the title of the paper. Even in places such as this, I am not much interested in the history of dogma, and so the paper is not about theology at Strasbourg, but the topic is the status of theological education at Strasbourg during the Reformation. For the most part, scholars interested in the history of theology during the Reformation have focused their efforts upon defining with great clarity the precise doctrines that 16th century theologians taught, but have paid scant attention to the changing status of theological education and reflection as such. To take but one example, the relationship between humanism and the Reformation, we know in great detail how Luther differed from Erasmus, Calvin from Luther, and so forth, in terms of their doctrinal positions. But we know very little about what these thinkers took to be the proper setting, institutional or otherwise, for theological activities. And yet I think it's evident that this issue too is at play. The humanists were for the most part amateur religious thinkers, who did not hold doctorates in theology, and whose work was not, in this sense, even marginally sanctioned by church or university. Luther, by contrast, always underscored his own possession of the doctorate, and, I'm sure you all recall, that a servo arbitrio left with gleam upon Erasmus' admission that he was not a professional theologian. Which remarked, boy, are you ever not a professional theologian? Their differing status as religious thinkers and the different status they accorded theology cohere well then with the humanists' emphasis upon true wisdom and piety on the one hand and the reformers' emphasis upon true doctrine and practice on the other. A question quite naturally poses itself in this regard to scholars who are interested in the second half of the 16th century, or the period that saw the emergence of the Reformation's enduring institutional relationships. Namely, was the status of theological education also at issue in the transition from reform to confessionalism during the late Reformation? I propose to offer a tentatively affirmative answer to this question by employing theological education in Strasbourg as a case study. Throughout the following, I shall remain, therefore, ignore what doctrines Strasbourg's religious thinkers taught, to focus instead upon who was to teach theology, or to put the matter differently, where theology was to be taught. Four events will serve to illustrate the changes that transpired. First, in the beginnings of theological education in Strasbourg, 1524-48. Secondly, the controversy between Johann Marbach, the president of the Company of Pastors, and Jerome Zanke, a theology professor at the Gymnasium, 1561-63. Thirdly, the controversy between Marbach and Johann Sturm, who was rector of what was by now an academy, 1569 and following. And finally, the controversy between Sturm and Johann Pappus, who became Marbach's successor, 1578-81. To reveal the conclusions first, and they're not very exciting, as theology became more and more a matter of doctrine, it came also to be taught more and more by the church. The beginnings of theological education in Strasbourg were fairly well known. Almost from their arrival in the city in the late 1520s, Capito and Bucer gave theological lectures as a part of their reforming activities. These lectures appear now to have been intended chiefly for the clergy, and to have had as one of their purposes converting many of them to the Reformed Party, in particular the canons of the Collegiate Church of St. Thomas. They continued into the late 1530s and eventually became formally a part of Sturm's new school, with Capito, Bucer, and Caspar Hegel serving as its first theologians. At roughly the same time, Strasbourg published its first evangelical church order, and Bucer, Capito, and Hegel featured prominently in it too. By now, Capito was the city's senior ecclesiastical statesman, Pater Ecclesiae, as Hegel termed him, while Bucer was the first president of the Company of Pastors, and Hegel the second. Accordingly, theological education and the ministry of the church were closely intertwined in Strasbourg from the very beginning, even if only in the persons of these three. The underlying issue here was also discussed, and quite explicitly so. For example, in his Hebrew Grammar of 1525, Capito declared that education in general had both religious and secular functions. I think he's following Luther's address to the city of Germany here. By the same means, he urged, let us nourish an honest and prudent citizenry within the Republic, moreover a populace spontaneous for Christ. Bucer, too, thought unequivocally that education had both civil and religious functions, and was therefore proper both to the city and to the church. Now, this community of opinion may be regarded as implicit in the formation of Sturm's famous school, a point that Anton Schindling, in his recent book, quite badly ignores. In fact, the question of the exact status of theological education came to the fore in these early years, even if there is no mention of it either in the statutes of the school or the church order of 1533-34. The first discussion of the matter came in response to a request from Basel. Briefly, Karlstadt, who now had come full circle, was arguing that all pastors should hold the doctorate, which position his opponents declared was foreign to the church because it created a special class of Christians. In his reply, Capito did not require the doctorate of all pastors, but instead discussed the general question whether the name or title of a doctor may exist in the community of God. Here on earth, he declared, it was important in theology, as in medicine and law, to know who had the right to teach. Consequently, the doctorate was allowable. But it made it decisively a matter in which the church was to be vitally involved. By maintaining that the granting of degrees in theology and what he called the Herrn der Kirchen should be bound together and should not be torn apart from one another. That's a quotation. 4 years later, he judged that if these two were divided, and I quote him again, the university would become heathen and stand in eternal anger in the church, with undoubted evil consequences to the church. Consequently, in the minds of the first generation of reformers, theological education was fundamentally an undertaking of the church, whence it received both its sanction and its status. The issue also received explicit institutional expression within Strasbourg itself in the 1540s. I have reference to the Collegium Brahmitanum, or the Collegium Predicatorum, whose existence is still celebrated by memorial plaque on the foyer of the chapter house of the Collegiate Church of St. Thomas. Begun by Hedio in 1542-43, these two colleges were base foundations for the support of poor students who would be candidates for the ministry. By the time Marcock became president of the Company of Pastors in 1552, these students were housed either in the cloister of St. William's or in Marcock's own home. The collegia were thus fundamentally bursae, with the consequence that the students' personal lives and intellectual growth were supervised by a different body of visitors from those who governed the gymnasium itself. Initially, the key figure was Hedio, and then Ludwig Rabus, pastor at St. Thomas, who, because he was not attending to his duties, eventually gave the post up to Marcock. Later, the task of supervising these two foundations was shared by Marcock and Sturm, but later yet found time to Marcock because Sturm was unwilling to put up with the administrative detail of the work involved. Through many twists and turns over time, these two collegia became the present Protestant seminary of the University of Strasbourg, which, as Professor Abel over here can well testify to, I think, to this day boasts by far the best Mensa in the city. A part of this brief history, in which they assure an atheist at minimum, is that these two institutions, governed as if they were one, were genuinely independent from the gymnasium. Consequently, many, if not most, of the ministerial candidates who attended the regular theological lectures were subject to an authority outside the city's famous school. In principle, they took the same courses and followed the same curriculum as the other baccalaureate students, but they were responsible to the president of the Company of Pastors for the progress of their studies, the conduct of their personal lives, and perhaps most importantly, their eventual advancement. As Marcock put it at the head of a partial list of such students, each, I quote him, me ex benevolentia clarissimi vii di doctoris Johannis Marcocchii receptum essa. Marcock was fully aware that he had these young men by the throat. Now this situation, not the one I just described, but the institutional relationships, was clearly unstable from the outset. It was unstable institutionally because the students were in principle subject to two separate authorities, the university and the church. It was also unstable in terms of the objectives that guided the students' education. Sturm intended the higher faculties to build upon the liberal and humanistic education that students had already received in the gymnasium. Schindler's quite clear about that. Marcock, however, saw a desperate need for pastors, especially in the countryside. Indeed, after staying with Marcock himself for 2 to 3 years, these young men quite commonly took village parishes where they discovered they were paid so little they could no longer afford to buy books. It would be too much to say that their theological education was ignored as they were pumped through Marcock's preacher's mill. Candidates were indeed refused admission and ordered back to their studies by the Company of Pastors if they were unable to explain the contents of the unaltered Augsburg Confession in a satisfactory manner, just as they were relieved of their preaching posts if they did not perform according to Marcock's high standards. This is quite evident from a detailed reading of Strasbourg's visitation reports in the entire second half of the 16th century that I just completed. But this is just the point. In Marcock's mind, the purpose of a theological education was to turn out competent pastors of Orthodox Lutheran persuasion. Theology thus served the objectives of the church in the most precise, even narrow way imaginable. Now, as indicated, not everyone in Strasbourg was in agreement on this point. Nonetheless, for several years, the school and the church seemed to have walked along rather nicely together, if not hand in hand, at least more or less in step with one another. A revision of the picture of Marcock is on its way now, so catch it. Martok did, in his diary, express reservations when Zanke came to the school in 1553. But once Zanke signed a statement according to which he acknowledged that it was the rule of the Senate in 21, Strasbourg's chief ruling body, that, and I quote, there'd be a consensus in teaching between the church and the school according to the true and properly understood doctrine contained in the Augsburg Confession, end of quote, Martok and the other pastors appeared to have been reasonably satisfied. Indeed, when Peter Martyr from Media returned to the city also in 1553 and effectively took Martok's place on the theological faculty, including his lecture hall, which Martok didn't find out until the morning he was due to give the lecture and came and found Martyr already at work, Martok, in fact, willingly made room for him. Moreover, he did so in the third hours that Martyr, and I quote his diary, does not hold the same view regarding the sacrament, but again contented himself with a pro forma subscription to the Augustana. In sum, the late 1550s provided no incident over which people disagreed in principle enough to raise the question of the formal status of theological education in Strasbourg. The controversy between Martok and Zanke, which broke out in March 1561, changed everything. And over 20 years of intermittent struggles, it settled the issue decisively in favor of the church. The details need not be repeated here, but it is necessary to emphasize the status of theological education as such did come to be an issue, as Zanke's desperate claim in the middle of it to a certain libertas docendi well reveals. In the first place, disagreements between Martok and Zanke surfaced when those ministerial candidates who lived with Martok reported to him what was going on in Zanke's classroom and the subject of predestination. Secondly, Martok insisted throughout the controversy that the doctrine Zanke taught were to be judged by the church and the church alone, albeit with the sanction of the civil authorities. Finally, and most tellingly for present purposes, the agreement that settled the dispute was titled, and I quote, a consensus between the theologians and the pastors, and took on, as will be seen, something of the force of law in the city. It should be quite obvious, therefore, that beneath the barrages of personal and doctrinal attack and counterattack, the formal status of theological education was very much at issue. Moreover, it was left unresolved because, although the theology professors agreed to teach according to the unaltered Augustana with much greater precision than heretofore, they and the pastors were explicitly recognized as two separate and equal groups in what amounted to a treaty between them. This constitutional stasis lasted about 6 years when it succumbed to an attack from Sturm. On this occasion, the conflict between church and school over the status of theology was in the open from the very beginning. Briefly, on December 19, 1569, Sturm requested a vote of confidence from the Skolarken, or lay commissioners for the school, in which he charged Martok with undermining his entire program. This request was not immediately granted. He offered his resignation, rather like Bismarck in William II. It is impossible to determine why Sturm mounted his assault at this time, although it is telling that just a year earlier, the gymnasium had been granted an imperial privilege as a semi-university. I'd note also, just in passing, it just occurred to me in the airplane when I was coming here, that by this time, accidentally, it had developed that all the theology professors were also pastors. So in a sense, the consensus was rendered nugatory by this gradual shift of who was doing the theology teaching. Equally, I think, we may ignore the florilegia of personal abuse and accusations of doctrinal impurity that accompanied the five-year struggle that ensued. The issue of who was to control theological education was present at the outset and became ever more central as the dispute raged on. On January 25, 1570, Sturm declared that one of the conditions under which he would agree to remain in his post was that all further appointments must be made pursuant to discussions with the entire faculty, and not with only a few people. Whereas before, the church in general, and Martok in particular, had always vetted new professors confessionally, and many appointments had been made by Martok and Sturm alone, or with the rubber stamp of the Skolarken. Moreover, declared Sturm, the theologians now were breaking the agreement of 1563. Quote him, the
theological disputations are presently held of such a kind and similar theses proposed as to reawaken the memory of our senseless and destructive controversy. He quoted in Sanhedrin 21. Here, Strom wished to censor, but could and could not be proper subjects for theological disputation. But above all, as became evident a year later, Strom was aiming at the two colleges in which Marpach's pastors were trained. Indeed, the heart of his reform proposal was, and I quote him, that the two colleges now be subject to the academic assembly. For it is from these two colleges that barbarism insinuates itself into our school. By his proposal, Strom intended not only that the school should take over supervising the stipendiate studies, but also the granting of stipends themselves. How many, for example? The school would therefore determine how many ministerial candidates there would be at any given time. To be blunt, it would have its hands around the throat of the church. Strom, in fact, attested to his seriousness about this matter when he declared in the School Arts in 1573, and I quote him, that neither unity, discipline, nor anything else that the needs of the school require can be accomplished or maintained so long as these colleges remain in the hands and under the authority of one person. That one person was Marpach, and through him, the church. Clearly, Strom had a very different vision of the school and of theological education in particular than did Marpach and the church. In fact, the plan of study for the two colleges with which Strom came forth in June 1572 was so weighted toward the typically humanistic curriculum that it included Luther's catechism only in the 8th and 9th classes. In just this regard, Strom's reasoning as to why the professors should be admitted to the deliberations of the company of pastors is most revealing. For the other professors, he charged, are excluded and cast out of their theologians' assembly. By this he means the company of pastors, really. Out of their theologians' assembly, and are considered by them to be such unlearned people who know nothing about the business, and so inept and incomprehending that we do not understand such matters and cannot judge and consider them. For Strom, the reverse is therefore true. That, in good humanistic fashion, the affairs of the church, to his mind, did not require professional attention. Any broadly educated person could discharge them. Understandably, the pastors were not in agreement. Marpach, feeling his honor blemished, initially washed his hands of the whole affair. In late 1574 or early 1575, he and the other pastors presented a lengthy document to the commission charged to judge the affair, in which they argued that the pastors and theologians should not be made subject to the school. Here Marpach declared the chief issues were that the theologians' lectures and doctrines would be judged, quote, by majority vote in the academic assembly, and that the ministerial candidates, who lived in Marpach's own house, and who held their stipends, quote, to the benefit of the general ministry of the church in Strasbourg, would now be subject to school discipline. For Marpach, it was unheard of that professors and teachers who were not theologians should have authority over the theologians. He pointed out that at the University of Ingolstadt, Freiburg, Basel, and Tübingen, after which Strasbourg's academy was modeled, the theologians met as a faculty to judge their own affairs, as in the faculties of law, medicine, and arts. In none of the Lutheran states, Marpach had it, are theological issues and matters of faith given over for grammarians and philosophers to judge and consider. In an almost prophetic manner, he declared, I quote him, it is impossible to maintain calm, peace, and unity between the clergy and the professors if the offices do not remain distinct. But then, between the principals, and more recently among historians, the dispute raged on regarding who, Marpach or Strom, was in the true tradition of Strasbourg's Reformation. And in fact, claiming that Marpach was is likely to get oneself in a lot of trouble if you do so on Strasbourg. For the most part, this argument has turned upon the extent to which Marpach was doctrinally true to Bucer and Capito. And most historians have agreed with Zanke and Sturm that he was not. And then have concluded that he was, in fact, a power-hungry ecclesiastical bureaucrat who sought to dominate the school as well as the church, and wished to drive from positions of authority all but the most strictly orthodox Lutherans.
And at my popular Lutheran, there can be no doubt. But it would seem to me that in the controversy with Sturm, he was more in harmony with the intentions of Bucer, Carpenter, and Hayden than was his antagonist, at least insofar as the controversy centered upon the status of theological education. And yet, on balance, Marcos lost this round. Initially, the government ordered the two parties to remain silent and not to interfere with one another's exercise of his office, which was precisely what Sturm requested. Then Marcos lost his position as dean of the academy, its highest elected post. Toward the end of 1573, he was also replaced as inspector of the two colleges, and the work was assumed by a committee of the academic assembly. Finally, in 1575, after having placed theological education firmly in the hands of the school, the Senate in 21 forced a peace treaty upon Marcos and Sturm, according to which they were to leave one another alone in the exercise of their offices, and entirely and in every respect, forgive and forget. Even copies of all the writings the affair spawned will be handed over to the government, which still possesses them. The two spheres of religion and education were therefore firmly separated, just as both parties had wished. But theological education, the theological training, was defined not as religious, but as an educational activity. And Marcos was not happy about it. Now, even though Marcos did not live to see it, this is a very temporary arrangement. Just 3 years later, Sturm foolishly embroiled himself in a controversy with Papus, who was both younger and tougher, and was then a theology professor and one of the visitors to the Collegium. And Sturm very badly overplayed his hand. The center of the struggle was the Formula of Concord and its condemnamus, by which subscribers condemned all opinions contrary to newly created Orthodox Lutheranism. Again, when we leave aside the doctrinal and political details of Sturm's demise, which I have seen in the paper in Kalamazoo, to focus on the status of theological education itself, for this was really the issue. The controversy broke out in March 1578 when Papus published and defended certain theses on whether the condemnamus violated the law of Christian love, or, more generally, as he always insisted, upon whether, in principle, the Church could ever judge doctrines without contravening the law of love. At base, he argued that there was a difference between condemning doctrines and condemning persons, and that the Church was obligated to distinguish among doctrines. Seems safe enough, but this opinion was not well received in the school. In fact, a certain Donatus Mauritius, a student associated with Professor Michael Boyter, attacked Papus so strenuously on doctrinal grounds that the scholars decided to censor the students after the pastors had mounted a vigorous pulpit campaign against what they called the Calvinistische Sakramentsschwärmer. Although he too eventually defended the Calvinist position as such, Sturm took a rather different approach initially. He charged Papus with failing to secure the required approval for his theses from the dean 2 weeks before publishing and defending them. Moreover, he added, they would never have been approved had no proceedings been followed, because the theses were ill-tempered and badly timed. Papus replied that he had in fact submitted the theses to the dean in Sturm's absence, and added that Sturm was seldom here but usually in his country estate, which was true. In addition, he insisted that he had considered the issues of the condemnamus only in principle, and that it was an opportune time to debate them due simply to the existence of the formula. And the controversy did, in fact, quickly turn into a roaring and ugly argument over the formula itself, and over whether Sturm and his supporters were or were not Calvinist sacramentarians. Yet Sturm's primary concern, and that of the pastors, remained the judgment of doctrines as such, and therefore pressed directly upon the status of theological education. What will occur, Sturm asked in 1580, after the formula of Concord is subscribed to? Will not the same be forthcoming as so unfortunately occurred at Heidelberg, Jena, Leipzig, and Wittenberg, where opponents were subsequently driven from their posts? Clearly, Sturm opposed making doctrinal judgments at all among non-Catholics, and he certainly opposed the idea of granting this authority to a class of professional theologians. He valued instead a well-educated and generally Christian religion that bespoke, I think, a truly Protestant humanism, and which didn't last very long. Without question, on the other hand, the position of Maurepas Proclus in the church also had its own integrity. Their fatal views in the matter are curiously evident from a misunderstanding that developed between them, Maurepas and Proclus, over who should pay the fee for Proclus' promotion to the doctorate by the University of Tübingen in 1573. In fact, Proclus had come to Strasbourg as a teacher of Hebrew, with the understanding that he would become professor of theology, and that the academy would pay for his promotion, 50 florins. But for a time, Sturm blocked the arrangement with the Scholarks, and told Proclus that Maurepas had caused it. In fact, he told Proclus that Maurepas was going around town telling everybody what a young fool Proclus was. Proclus became very angry. Eventually, the misunderstanding, which almost prompted Proclus to leave the city, was resolved by the mediation of the company of pastors and is attested to in two lengthy documents you may find at AST 165. Proclus, in fact, received his doctorate and was promoted to professor, and the academy paid the bill. In fact, throughout, Maurepas had regarded Proclus as his own successor and considered possession of the doctorate essential to give Proclus extra authority. As the importance both parties placed upon the doctorate indicates, Maurepas and Proclus approached theological education and authority in matters of doctrine from a position diametrically opposed to their Sturm. And the most intriguing aspect of this entire affair, and one which needs explanation, is that this time the Senate in 21 came to agree with the company of pastors. To be sure, there was no rewriting of the Academy's constitution, and no overt repudiation of Sturm's creation, as there was in Sturm himself. But that the Senate in 21 had this time come down decisively on the side of the church regarding the status of theological education is evident from the frequent and lengthy discussions that followed the death of Maurepas on March 18, 1581, and continued until the appointment of Proclus as his successor on November 29. Proclus was the leading candidate from the outset, but, interestingly, the first evidence that he was so comes from a discussion in the Senate in 21 about what was to be done with the ministerial candidate, the believer of Maurepas, on whom his will no longer mattered,